I'd like to announce the next paper in this session, Collaborating with Language Communities in a diasporic Context, Three Case Studies from New York City, by Daniel Kaufman from the Endangered Language Alliance and Habib Bourdian, Columbia University in DLA.
Here's the outline of the talk. I wanted to talk about the role of cities in language documentation. It's something that actually at this conference and similar conferences, it's not spoken about much. Most of the discussions are about field work and all of the issues surrounding traditional field work in the field. We've been specializing in our organization and working with immigrant communities in diasporic settings that have totally different challenges and different scenarios. So I wanted to introduce that and talk about a little bit about our activities, a bit about a typology of linguistic scenarios for immigrant languages or diaspora languages, and really focus on a case study of three Iranic languages of New York City spoken by Jewish communities. So the original motivations, just to give a little background about the organization, was that there were thousands of speakers of undescribed and undocumented languages living with us in every major American city, and yet we didn't know nearly a thing really about these communities. The traditional means of finding out about populations like the census were more or less useless. There were dozens of linguistic students interested in language documentation and collaborating with native speakers. And then there was very little networking between linguistics departments and local language communities, with some exceptions, of course, but it's not the norm. And just as a methodology, we look back in the history of linguistics, and we see people like Leonard Bloomfield, who wrote one of the most impressive descriptive grammars of any Philippine language, and he did it in Chicago with a single student, a graduate student in engineering. So why weren't things like that being done on a larger scale? And actually, one of the models for it, and I'm not saying it just because I'm in Hawaii, is the Language Documentation Training Center here at the University of Hawaii. They basically bring in speakers from different departments, not necessarily linguists, and teach them how to document their own languages in a casual way. It doesn't have to be a really in-depth project, but that was kind of an inspiration. So a later development, once we started moving, was that we discovered there were a large number of language activists. They emerged from the woodwork, and the hunch was basically confirmed that it's time to start building urban community networks for underdocumented, threatened, and indigenous languages. Cities are growing at an exponential pace. At the same time, rural agricultural villages in impoverished countries are emptying out. So whatever need we have today to address this problem in cities is only going to increase as time passes. So just a quick overview of what it is we do, easier to explain in pictures. This is our office. It's a modest office in Manhattan, and this cast of characters includes undergraduate students, graduate students, native speakers of languages that we have projects on. All of them are, as you see, either doing some kind of annotation work or other types of documentation work. They're all doing it on a volunteer basis. Some of them are able to use what they do in their classwork. But it gets relatively busy. Again, we're a modest operation, but it gets relatively busy in the summer. A lot of students come back home to the city and want to be involved in some kind of documentation projects. As a pilot, we've begun last summer to do a mother tongue literacy project, the first of its kind in New York City, with a small group of Mixteco speaking mothers. This is a beginning. It's something that needs funding, and it's something that needs, there's a great need for it in New York City now, as there's hundreds of monolingual Mixteco speakers who are kind of linguistically isolated on the one hand, but also some of which have a real passion for their language. So being able to interact with their language in any capacity is a relatively new thing in New York City. So we're trying, and this is a new population in New York City, unlike in California. So this is something that we're trying to do. We facilitate speaker-driven documentation, so we have certain people who are on their own motivated to create their own stories, to write their own poems, all kinds of different narratives. They come in, they record, and we help them transcribe. And of course, none of the linguists really have time to become experts in all of the languages that we work with, but we can do enough to make decent transcriptions and then collaborate with linguists who do have that expertise. This is a Senaida Cantu, a Tlapaneco speaker from Malinaltepec in Guerrero. Another recent project, Indigenous Radio, something which people probably wouldn't have thought was possible in New York City. This is a Leopardo, who's a speaker of Quiche from Guatemala, and he took it upon himself to build an internet radio station within our office and recruit speakers of different indigenous languages of Latin America to have their own shows in internet radio. So this is completely his initiative, and we were just able to facilitate it, but it's again in a pretty amazing and unique phenomenon, and definitely in New York. He had been doing community radio back in Guatemala. We're creating venues for performance, so languages that are not even spoken in public, we try to give them an opportunity, even though if it's only a fleeting opportunity, it can have symbolic significance for a lot of the communities. This is from a series we did called Unheard Of, and we highlighted all different kinds of oral literature from different languages. This is a speaker of Totempoan, a language from North Sulawesi. Similar thing. Awareness building, trying to just expose New Yorkers and the broader public to some of the language issues that different communities are experiencing. There's a tremendous issue with indigenous Mexican populations from Guerrero and Oaxaca, many of which are monolingual, and a ton of discrimination, a ton of ignorance on the part of the school system, which results in many children being left back. So this is a kind of urgent social issue that needs to be addressed. And we're trying to do it in our own little way. Again, it's something that needs more support. And pedagogical materials, again, as much as we can. Symposiums occasionally. Okay, so the main goal of the talk is to show what kind of scenarios and challenges exist for diaspora languages, how an organization like ELLA has to be flexible in addressing different needs and opportunities. And the covert goal, as always, is to encourage others to create urban language community networks, right? Because I think that this is really has to be a movement in the future. So there's a wide range of social scenarios, of course, as you can imagine, in a big city. On one hand, you have indigenous undocumented immigrants with no formal education, who are basically on the bottom of New York City's socioeconomic ladder. On the other hand, you have well-established refugee communities with high levels of education and a large number of professionals. As far as individuals go, you have those who don't speak, don't have a community. They're the only speakers, at least that they know of, in the city. You have others who are very active. They're creative writers, they're storytellers, they're activists of some nature. And you have those who don't care, as one would expect. They don't have a special interest in their language. Where do New York City's threatened languages come from? These are some countries. I feel that these are the countries that are now the largest source for threatened languages in New York City. Certainly Mexico, I think, is on top. Nepal, over the last 15 years, maybe. Guatemala, Sudan, on a much lower level. Central Asia, since the 1980s. Indonesia, to a much smaller extent, and other places, just to give a very rough idea. So the case study is on three languages: Bukharian, Juhuri, and Judeo-Kashani. They're all languages of the Iranian family. Why are they all Jewish? The Jewish communities came in very large numbers to New York City. Also, they happen to preserve the languages of their locales better than Muslim populations because they were less susceptible to the larger national trends shifting to Persian. And national languages in other countries. So the area we're looking at is about there. More specifically, this triangle, including Juhuri, up top, Bukharian and Kashani. Juhuri and Bukharian, the two languages on top, are much more related to each other than Kashani, which is quite different. Juhuri and Bukharian are also much more closely related to Persian. So Bukharians is a large community, around 60,000, based in Forest Hills and Rigo Park in Queens. There's a long history of commerce that goes back to the time of the Silk Route. In New York, basically it's hair, shoe repair, and the diamond business, which accounts for the majority of their employment. They came almost entirely in the 80s and 90s, and they, in a large way, of the change in the demography of certain parts of Queens. And as Russian speakers, they kind of have one foot in the European Jewish community and another foot as part of the larger Iranian world. They have better connections with Iran and Afghanistan culturally. The language is a variety of the Tajik language. Itself is considered a dialect of Persian. There's been few descriptions of it, but that's most likely due to its minor differences from better described languages. The community isn't really sure how to refer to the language. It's called Tajik sometimes, sometimes Farsi. Bukharid is another language which has the implication that it's an independent language. There's writers, different kinds in the New York City community, but anybody who is involved artistically with the language is typically writing in a totally formal language that cannot really be called Bukharian at all. It's really standard Persian. So although there's a large base of speakers at present, the language is not being passed down at all to children in the diaspora. And this is important because all three languages here are spoken more in the diaspora than they are in their places of origin, right? We often, people for some reason always ask us about languages that are spoken more outside their place of origin. These three are examples of that. So if a language is not being passed down in an immigrant setting for these guys, then it's likely not going to be spoken at all by the community. It can't really, in the case of Bukharian, it can't really be considered an endangered language because it's really in a dialect relationship to really large national languages like Tajik, Persian, and Dari. At the same time, it is an entire population that's distinct, and it's undergoing a large scale language shift, and they're being completely disconnected from their linguistic roots. So there's been a bit of ambiguity. Many of the reputable sources consider these dialects as endangered languages, and reputable funding agencies have also considered languages like this as endangered languages. Reputable, is there an irreputable funding agency? I'm not sure. They have the money, they're reputable. So from a morphological and syntactic perspective, Bukharian has little news to offer, if we're familiar already with Tajik and Persian. A grammatical description may be superfluous, but there's clearly aspects like intonation, gesture, use of Hebrew vocabulary, and dialect features that could be better documented. Among the community desires, as far as these go, there's a desire to pass on the language. In reality, though, wherever you go in this community, it's Russian, which is the dominant language. You very rarely hear Bukharian spoken in the public sphere. They do have language classes in the Bukharian synagogue. It's interestingly taught in a Latin orthography, which renders the students unable to connect to the written part of their history. So to sum up, what is in this kind of scenario, what can an organization like us do, and how should we prioritize a situation like that? Well, there's little we could do to add to the ongoing pedagogical efforts. The community actually has resources, and there's a ton of resources for Tajik and Persian for sure, that can be modified for their purposes. And there's little to add to the academic literature in Bukharian. So essentially here, we've done pretty shallow level documentation, we could say. We've recorded things about language attitudes, personal narratives, and songs, both in New York and in Toronto. The Juhuri community is a much different situation, a much smaller community. They come from, mostly in New York, they come from a place called Quba in Azerbaijan, and there is the small city of Quba, and I believe that top little sliver is the Jewish community on top, and the Jewish quarter. This is the community in New York City during a festival. They call themselves Mountain Jews, typically mountain and Jews, not two things that go together, but with these guys, it's their defining thing, called Gorsky Jews, which is basically mountain Jews. It's a community of around 20,000. They're based in Brooklyn, mostly from Cuba, as I said. And it's a small subgroup that two languages are in it, the Jewish Tat and Muslim Tat. Jewish Tat is also called Juhuri, which just means Jewish in the language. They see their language as the Jewish language. They call their language Jewish. That's how they call it. And they call the Azeri language Muslim, the Muslim language. Right? But there's no direct contact with the language that's most closely related to them, that is Muslim tongue. Jewry had a literature, but it basically lost half of its authors and cultural creators during World War. The community is very cohesive, but it's rapidly shifting away from Jewry. There is a newspaper, it's entirely in Russian, and that's actually the norm for different ethnic minorities in New York. In Israel, they face great discrimination, both with the larger society and also with different minorities from the Soviet sphere. As Bram says, they learn to think about their language as something belonging not only to the past, but to a completely different and even inferior cultural sphere. But yet they're able to maintain it as an artistic, a language of art, at least the older generation in Israel. They have a theater in Jewry, although the children are not learning the language at all. This is from a survey we did in the Brooklyn community, showing that the community basically came in to Brooklyn with Azeri, Jewry, and Russian, and one generation later, they're just coming out with marginal Russian and English. But Russian is the only common language between the youngest and oldest population in the community. Just to run through some features, since I have very little time, it's a much more, compared to Bukharian, far less described language and a far more interesting language historically, perhaps. So there's layers of Persian, of Hebrew, of Azeri elements. The phonology has some mysterious elements to it, the pharyngeals, so ov versus ov, water versus game. The source of those pharyngeal phonemes is still mysterious. Syntactically, it seems to be quite conservative. Sociolinguistically, it's interesting. It's one of the few Jewish languages that doesn't bear a close relation to the language of the surrounding non-Jewish society. Just to give a very rough idea of the similarities and differences between Jewry and Persian, you can see it in one sense, it's quite similar. If you look at the B sentences, I said that I didn't know you. Structurally, they're almost identical, and even the lexemes are all cognate. At the same time, a simple sentence like, these are my friends, looks entirely different. So it's mostly lexical differences, phonological differences, and morphological differences as well. But it's a closely related language that underwent some serious changes. I won't go through this. Another aspect specific to working with Jewish languages is that there is this Hebrew paralanguage, which is only used in prayer. And that in itself is something that's quite crucial to document, especially as concerns the origins of the community. So the origins of the entire community are kind of shrouded in mystery. The way they pronounce Hebrew, though, shows that there is a link to the Babylonian exile. But I won't get into that now. That's kind of a unique feature of working with Jewish languages. So there's been top-down approaches in trying to keep this language vital. There is a large charity that has created these television programs for teaching the language. They're, I would say, not done very well, although they're very fancy looking, almost psychedelic, I would say. They're so overproduced. But it's a lot of discussion in Russian, and then you kind of learn a couple of words in Jewry. But it's a regular thing, I think, that can be seen on that television station in Azerbaijan. And in the New York City community, there's one guy who's not a trained teacher, he's an engineer, Simon Mardukhaev, and he has taken it upon himself to do language classes in the community without really much of a lesson plan or much training. So the approach to Jewry, some accomplishments and goals, what have we done so far? We published an assessment of the vitality of the language in New York City together with a short history of the language. We helped convene a meeting of activists and different figures in the Jewry language scene at Columbia University, and I wouldn't have considered that a major thing, but for the community, that was a very major thing to have a conference in about the language in New York City, in a place like Columbia University, seemed to add a lot of prestige to their efforts. What do we want to do? In this case, it is worth really investing time in comprehensive audiovisual documentation of the New York City community, including oral histories and so forth. and resources for aiding language transmission. Unlike the Bukharian case, there's really nothing much at all for Juhuri. And so this is something that, that they could use help with. It's not to say that everybody sees things in the same way. Our main collaborator, Yakov Abramov, is kind of obsessed with orthography reform, which is understandable. But he thinks that orthography reform is really in itself going to change the language situation, right? Which is not an uncommon sentiment, but in reality, orthography reform, while it could be a good idea, it's not going to make a big change on its own, right? So we're more interested in the documentation side and also just creating new social spaces for the use of Juhuri in that community. The last community is the most extreme on the decline of language endangerment. It's spoken by only a small handful of individuals in Great Neck, Long Island. It's very distinct, so it's a totally different language from Persian. It's severely endangered, as I said. It's native to the city of Kashan. It was virtually undocumented until a recent article by my co-presenter, Habib Bourjian. And there are thousands of people living in the United States. Very few of them are fluent speakers, though. The speakers in this case, they don't really, at least we haven't come across speakers who are really concerned with passing on their language. They don't see Kashani as a language of culture. They see Persian as the language of culture, the language of literacy and history. And that's actually the language that they want to pass on to their children, not their native tongue, Kashani. That's just to show the differences between Judeo-Kashani and Persian. It's different in many respects. It's a median language. Habib is the one to ask about that. But structurally, there's quite major differences. I won't get into them. As I said, we haven't found anybody particularly interested in keeping Kashani alive. Documentation isn't very easy because there aren't really any fluent speakers. They're more like rememberers than fluent speakers. Our main consultant, collaborator, Jacques Tabari, had to actually compose his stories on paper before he could read them, right? So he was really maybe the last reader rather than the last speaker. So what we've done with this is more of an academic approach, creating a corpus in Flex of stories for an eventual sketch grammar of the language. The corpus should be available online to be maximally useful to linguists and Iranists. It looks something like this. Through the good graces of the National Science Foundation, we have funding to build the framework for the electronic corpus. So three extremely different approaches. In this case, there is really no audience for revitalization, no audience for pedagogical materials. The biggest audience for materials in Kashani may be linguists, in fact, unfortunately. So the conclusion is that there is a great need to create, I think, these networks, but one has to be prepared to do things that one wasn't trained to do, as something that's often emphasized in these talks. Certainly one cannot take a kind of field methods approach to every community. In some cases, intervention and collaboration with pedagogical stuff is really important, and linguists are actually seen, as other people have noted, as resources, as valuable resources that can add a lot to kind of incipient language movements within these communities. So just the mere act of collaboration often sets off, functions as a catalyst. So I'll leave it there. Sorry for going over time. In the case of the Bukharian and the Juhuri community, I would say yes. There are many members from the Juhuri community that go back and forth. It's more difficult, I believe, in the Iranian in the situation of the Kashani population, although maybe Habib knows more than I how much people go back and forth. My feeling is that the Iranian Jews don't go back a lot.
They are very in touch with other Persian communities in the United States, both in California and New York, and they hold concerts and theater and all kinds of activities with other Iranians, but in terms of going back and forth, they do not as much as rather.
So the identity is as a diasporic community rather than?
Yeah, the diasporic population is much, much larger than the population that's left back home. Okay.
Thank you.
You said a little bit about the structural similarities or dissimilarities between Persian and these different varieties. So what about if you compare the ones that are back home? Is there more convergence with Persian, the ones that are in New York City versus the ones that are in the old country? So with the examples that we saw, just very quick, they looked quite similar, although you had said that perhaps they were different. So I was just wondering about the
similarity between Persian and Arabic among two languages considerably. In terms of the last language, Judeo-Kashan is totally different than Persian structure. In the grammar, it's very different. Judeo-Kashan is a very different language than Persian. It's not, for instance. In terms of lexicon, it's all substantially different as well. But as to whether how much they have assimilated Persian back home and here, you should consider that this is a virtually extinct language. Only few individuals, I don't know how many, few dozen, but there is no way to tell. But I would consider each of the speakers the last speaker or a last speaker because they don't speak to each other. They don't speak it at home to their children and grandchildren. And they happen to see each other. It's an extinct language. It's hardly to find a good speaker. This was a speaker who could just write it down and then read it out. And there are other speakers whose language was mixed speakers. So we didn't get the idea of text. But maybe it's not more text.
To these cases, I can't speak directly to these cases because our work has been mostly in New York, but in other cases I've seen much more convergence back home than with the speakers in New York City. In the one case that I had a real chance to do field work both in New York City and in the home village, Mamuju, is an Indonesian language, the speaker I worked with in New York City was able to speak basically a kind of pure form of Mamuju that nobody seemed capable of doing back home. It was massive code switching and massive borrowing. So that was interesting, and that was the result of him being, he just didn't go through the period of code mixing back home. When he was living in his village, there was no code mixing. People did not know Indonesian. He left before people learned Indonesian.
As an organization mean that communities sometimes take the initiative to approach you, or do you face the difficulty that way around, you say contact social services, or which in my experience is often, well, if you're looking for a language community, there's a barrier there because of confidentiality issues.
No, at this point actually a lot of communities in New York approach us, which happened really due to one or two articles that kind of put us on the map, and so that after that we've gotten more attention than we could really handle in a sense. But in the early days we would pound the pavement and go to community centers and all the various organizations that had direct contact with the